Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, former General Counsel to the Republican National Committee David Norcross looks at Edmund Burke and the origins of modern conservatism. Mr. Norcross is a guest lecturer at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, in a course called The Conservative Intellectual Tradition in America, taught by Citadel International Politics and Government Professor Mallory Factor. This is an hour and a half.
Well, he is indeed a great friend, which I suppose explains the generosity of that introduction. I thank you. This topic is particularly apt today. You hear a lot, particularly in the Republican primary, about who is a conservative, who is not, what is a conservative. And you could do no better than Edmund Burke as a template for what conservatism really is. So you might ask somebody whom you wonder whether they are a conservative or not, what do you know about Edmund Burke? Well, clearly not every conservative knows a whole lot about Edmund Burke. Many have probably not read Edmund Burke. So at that point, you can move to some things we're going to talk about today, some things you're going to hear about today, and talk to them about what they think about these various principles. I think Edmund Burke and his principles describe the classic conservative. Now, somebody's political philosophy, right, left, center, how far right, how far left, is a pretty personal thing, and it's pretty complex. And the use of labels is probably not the best of ideas. But in your own mind, you probably want to know. Mallory mentioned the fact that in New York, I had to deal with folks of all stripes, all Republicans, left, right, center of the Republican Party. One of the ways I did that was by not trying to put any of them into a particular box. But Burke will give us a yardstick, a box, if you will, in which to see whether principles or people fit, and give you a way to judge how they think. You can't understand Burke without an understanding of English history. And I think you cannot understand the origins of America, and therefore American history, unless you understand Burke. So I guess what I'm really saying, bottom line about all of that, is you can't really understand American history, American political philosophy, American conservatism, without an understanding of English history. I have thought for many years that American history really didn't begin to start in 1776 or even 1750. It started probably in the Norman conquest of England in 1066. And that understanding that helps you understand Burke, because it is that background and that history that it all happened before Edmund Burke arrived on the scene in 1729. Consider that just 40 years before Burke was born, that takes us what, back to about 1970, a long time ago for many of you, not so long for me. But just 40 years before Burke was born, there was an English Revolution. It was called the Glorious Revolution. It was, for the most part, bloodless. Michael Barone, I think, is going to talk at some time in this series. And Michael Barone is the author of a book which you should definitely all read, whether it ends up in the required reading or not. I almost put it on my list, because he talks about the Glorious Revolution, only he calls it our first revolution. That was 1689. And the English at that point, in essence, picked a king. It's interesting to read Burke's explanation for how they selected a king but didn't elect the king. And there are some nuances in English history that make it clear why he can't say they selected the king. What they did was follow the bloodline, which was a strong tradition and guideline for the English, to select a person who met the requirements of the bloodline and yet would be a king to do what they needed to have done, which frankly was to be rid of James II and his Catholicism, to be replaced with a Protestant who was interested, they thought, in the development of a British culture and commerce. You must also understand that during Burke's time, England was pretty much the America of today. It was a world power, had, I think, without dispute, the strongest, most powerful navy in the world. Navies are obviously still of enormous importance, perhaps beginning to get of more importance. But in the period of the 1700s, a strong navy was absolutely essential if you were going to be a world power. So, 1679, they pick a king. 1649, that's just another 40 years back, they executed a king. And they chose another leader. Cromwell led the Commonwealth. Then in 1660, they chose another king. So we have in the course of, what, 100 years, we have three chief executives selected by the English people without an election, but a very decided shift in control and who is in control. You would think that in the period between the time they executed Charles I and the time they put William and Mary in power, that the country would have been in turmoil. But it really wasn't. It really wasn't. The country continued to be a commercial, military success. It continued to grow. It grew without any serious disruption at home in terms of commerce or the day-to-day life of individuals. I should add that also in 1714, just before Burke was born, they picked a whole new line. William and Mary died childless. Anne had no children, so they came to another roadblock. They picked the House of Hanover. They found a German elector. They chose him. Burke is careful to say they didn't elect him, but they selected him. So again, we have what? We have four changes in the course of 100 years, and England soldiered on. The merchants in England continued to be successful. They continued to grow. English commerce grew. Commerce amongst themselves grew. There was, in that period of time, the country thrived. In that period of extreme, you would think turmoil, possibility for turmoil, there was little disruption. So this is the world into which Burke was born, the world in which he became a politician, spent many, many years in Parliament, was in leadership only a very short period of time, was in opposition much of that time. But Burke's philosophy, I think, was shaped by those extremely important, potentially disruptive events which England survived, and not only survived, but thrived. Through that whole period, Parliament gained strength. In part because it was the vehicle for selecting the new kings. Parliament actually, when they restored Charles II to the throne, there actually was no parliament, but parliament came together, created the restoration, restored the crown to Charles II, and then passed an act legitimizing itself. In essence, they said, well, we weren't really parliament when we chose the king, but now that he's chosen and he's here and we're in place, we're going to say we were parliament. Fairly smooth transition. We've had transitions in this country from president to president, not as smooth as that was. So one of the Burke tenets is that government is necessary. And there is a divergence on this point between Burke and Paine. As a matter of fact, Burke, much like Blackstone, said any government is better than no government. And clearly, that 100 years before Burke was born, and when he was becoming active in politics, a smoothly functioning government was essential, and was essential to the continuation of people's comfort and people's commercial development. You can't understand U.S. history without understanding that period of time and the growth of the power of people to select their leaders by means that were not revolutionary, even if the Glorious Revolution was called a revolution. One of the things about Burke, and I am going to throw this in now because I don't want to forget it, one of his biographers, Utley, points out that Burke's development in no small measure was because of his prolonged and undisciplined reading. Think about that. Prolonged and undisciplined reading. Immersed in history. And that appreciation for history and that appreciation for how the country continued to develop through what could have been a very bumpy time is the basis for Burke's philosophy. At all times, through all of those potential upheavals, the preservation of existing freedoms was foremost in the English psyche. And that's how it became part of our psyche. Burke saw that, understood like nobody else in his time, I believe, and that might be unfair to Blackstone, but like nobody else in his time, that preservation of existing freedoms was essential to progress and the goodness of human life. That is the fullness of the life that you get to lead. Understanding all the while that throughout this, every time there was a bump in the road, Parliament came up with a little more power. And if you think about it from the regicide of Charles I to where the British are now, and to where we are now in terms of the power of the people and of legislative bodies, you will understand that it is that development that shaped Burke that has shaped the Britain of today and the United States of today. So, when somebody asks you, as I asked my son many times when he was very young, what are you reading now? You can tell them, I am doing prolonged and undisciplined reading. And if it was good enough for Edmund Burke, it's got to be good enough for me and you too, Dad. That undisciplined reading, I suspect, had a lot to do with history, and he certainly had a history that was full of lessons and full of potential pitfalls. to deal with as he came into his own as a politician. And as I said, always in opposition, with the exception of a very, very brief period of time. Also, he was of the period of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason. And they were, at that time, they were just beginning to roll over into Romanticism. Burke was not really a man of either of those philosophies, which makes him all the more interesting. He was pretty much a man of his own philosophy, his own thought, and his own undisciplined reading. He had his debates with Rousseau, who was very much more a believer of the goodness of man. Burke was not, incidentally. Burke realized that man, woman, left to their own devices, without government, wouldn't lead very happy lives, wouldn't understand much progress, and wouldn't progress. So for him, the romantic notion that you can create government out of reason, which I believe is essentially where the French were after the French Revolution and before, they destroyed the model. Burke never thought that was an alternative. He never separated human reason from historical experience. Remember particularly two words from that sentence: one, history; two, experience. They are two, along with tradition, which is the third, keys to who Burke was and what Burke thought. And when I suggested to you that you might say to somebody, okay, you think you're a conservative, what do you think about Burke? And they say, I don't think anything about Burke. Did he play third base for the Cincinnati Reds or what? Then you can ask them what they think about history, what they think about tradition, what they think about experience as a foundation for society and for a political philosophy. If you think about it and you look back on all that I've talked about that happened in the 100 years before Burke was born and immediately preceding Burke's birth, experience, that is the experience of people with the situation with which they were confronted, was something that if you considered, you saw how to get from point A to point B with minimum disruption experience. You look at history, what is it that we are trying to preserve? What is it about our way of life that is most important to us? To Rousseau, it was probably man's ability to figure out how to make everything better. To Burke, it was to figure out, how do I keep progress coming? Not fast, not abrupt, but keep it coming. I talked a minute ago about the progress of Parliament from regicide to the choosing of the Hanovers in the early 1700s. Parliament was always there. The day-to-day life of Englishmen didn't change all that much. They focused on history, daily experience, past experience, and tradition. Now, people think of tradition in terms of something dry. Tradition isn't dry at all. Tradition is the everyday life of today looked at 40 years hence. And one of the concerns of today is that we may be abandoning traditions and years of experience which have kept us progressing. That's a thought about Burke that applies to today. And you need to ask yourselves whether when candidates talk in terms of the America as we have known it, what Burke's position would have been, and more importantly, what is our position going to be as we have choices to make going forward. Burke, tradition, history, experience, survival in times of potential upheaval, I think describes why Great Britain today and the United States today are so very different than virtually any other model of government in the world. And yes, they've got a king and we've got a president that we elect every 4 years. But have you ever asked yourself, why are there such difficulties in other parts of the world with what we assume is second nature? Well, it's because it is second nature. And it is second nature because we have respected history and tradition and experience. And that has produced two pretty good countries in which to live. But you see how I'm getting from executing King Charles to 2012. There is a continuum of development in the United States, a continuum that Burke not only would have understood, but I suspect would have expected. One of the notions of conservatism is that it is a rejection of change. And I think you will hear that as a simplistic explanation from most any liberal that you get into a serious conversation with. That's not really true. It isn't a resistance to change. It is a resistance to the rejection of history, tradition, and experience. And what people are saying today, regardless of how you feel about the healthcare plan, I think you must concede that it is a significant change in a tradition that involves a very large part of American economic society. So, I'm not here to say, I have my views, you can probably guess what they are, but I'm not here to say that we shouldn't change. No more than Burke would say you shouldn't change. I am here to say how you do the change matters. And that the fact that the English and then the Americans, who were after all for the most part English when we started this experiment, how they viewed progress and change. Think about, it's an interesting sidelight, but you know when the American Revolution was over, there were folks who offered the crown to George Washington. If you think about Burkean philosophy and you think about Americans who knew about Burke, you can certainly understand why somebody said, well, hey, this is not William and Mary, but it's not George III, but this looks like the way to get, this looks like the way to move forward without radical change. The secret to to our success and to our foundation is that we got past that with a pretty radical change. You ever wonder what would have happened if George Washington had said, well, hey, okay, not a bad idea. Might have worked. But I think at that point we had understood that we could make the change, we could keep the traditions, we could embrace the progress without going back to a king. Anyway, what would Burke have said about that? Was Burke alive when, I guess Burke was alive when Washington was offered the crown. I've not seen in the readings anywhere what he said, but maybe that's what I want to do. Maybe if I get the one question of an historical figure, maybe I want to ask Burke, what if we had crowned George, our George, sort of their George anyway, as well. Can't separate human nature from human experience. The French did, the French Revolution. They threw it all out. They threw out the church, they threw out the king, they threw out the nobility, killed most of them. They did a do-over. And the do-over didn't work. And unsurprisingly, and in fact predictably, Burke said it wasn't going to work. Thomas Jefferson, you may know, this observation may be close to blasphemy in my now home state. Thomas Jefferson thought pretty highly of the French Revolution. Had some significant little dust-ups with folks here about it. And Burke had serious, serious combat over his position on the French Revolution. So he wasn't hidebound. He wasn't a man who didn't understand change. He supported the American Revolution. He was appalled by the French Revolution. And he was appalled because when the French got done, there was nothing left of history, of tradition, and there was no experience to go on with where they found themselves. And so, with the help of reason and the human mind, and knowing that man is good, they tried to create something new. The something new was the Reign of Terror, decried by Burke, who watched it. And then, when that was over, they fell into a kind of, well, Napoleon. And that's a whole other avenue. Is Napoleon like Cromwell? Napoleon certainly would not have been a Burke favorite. So you look at the French Revolution and you look at the American Revolution, you see the difference. French tore it all down. In today's parlance, they threw the baby out with the bathwater. Tore it all down, started over. Without a great result. That is particularly an appropriate examination for today. Let's look at a series of revolutions. The Glorious Revolution we've talked about. Pretty easy, little bloodshed. Shuffled one king off to France. In a reasonably happy frame of mind. Picked a new one with the proper bloodlines. Turned out to be just fine. There you go. The Glorious Revolution, the French Revolution. The American Revolution, we've got a little comparison going there between the three of those. But I want you to add three more upheavals to your thoughts. The Russian Revolution, pretty well tracks the French, with even worse results. So add the Russian Revolution and how a-Burkean, if I can coin a phrase, how a-Burkean that was. Then there's two others I want you to think about. I want you to put the Civil War, the war between the states, let's not defend any side. I want you to put that in the mix. I have thought about that only superficially because it popped up while I was preparing for this lecture. It was, in many ways, a failed revolution. And it has taken a long time for us to get over it, assuming the majority of us are over it. But no great challenge to the institutions of government. Both South and North followed Burkean principles, history, tradition, experience. And when it was all over, unpleasant as that was and difficult as it was, the South was able to come back to the tradition and experience and history they understood, even though they didn't like to. But it wasn't the institutions that got challenged in that war. And that's why Burke would say that's why we got through it. But there's one other current revolution I want you to put into that mix, because I think it will help you understand where it's going to go. And that is multiple revolutions. That's the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring thus far appears to be ignoring all of Burke. But they don't really have the tradition. So it's not so hard to ignore what is our tradition and not theirs. Huge part of Burke's tradition and history is religion. And bear in mind, of course, Burke's talking about not 40 years after the English have thrown out a Catholic king because he was Catholic and brought in a Protestant king because he was a Protestant. And when George I was selected, you better believe they made sure he was a Protestant. So it isn't that there wasn't contention between religions in Burke's day. It is that Burke is looking at religion. Throwing religion into the Arab Spring gives you an opportunity for a whole different lecture. Fascinating. Seems they've got to do their... Well, I started to say they've got to do their revolution without religion. I'm not at all sure, being a Burkean, that you can do that. I am sure that you need to keep religion out of the front parlor of the executive mansion. And Burke himself, though deeply religious, and though mindful of how important religion is and was very much opposed to making religion a part of government life. He was an early separation of church and stater, although clearly he was talking about separation and not freedom from. And I'll get to that in just a moment. But fascinating, I think, those revolutions. There's a book, The Anatomy of Revolution by Crane Britton. Worth reading, compares Russian, American, English. as you read that in part of your indiscriminate reading, think about where the Arab Spring fits into Crane Britain's book. And that will be particularly interesting because Britain, I think Britain does not understand or acknowledge the role of religion in the American Revolution and in, therefore, our beginning. So, Burke has trouble with the French Revolution because human nature is king, man is not inherently good. I think in a nutshell, I'm not here to talk about Robespierre, so I can get away with being glib on this. I think that the French thought that man being inherently good, they could put something nice together. And Burke, by the way, says that the king wasn't nearly as bad as we read in the history books. But Burke did believe that liberty was God's gift. And we're going to get to that in a moment too. So, the English Revolutions started in 1215 when the barons told King John, you gotta stop taking stuff away from us. You're taking our power away. You gotta give us some. Now, these were enormously wealthy landed people. This was not Joe Sixpack, not even Joe the Plumber. Start in 1215, it was gradual, all through this change, even through Henry VIII. Parliament survived, waxing and waning, more powerful, less powerful. And that survival and that growth, I think, is why we are the way we are today. Burke's opposition to the French Revolution was a very contrarian notion. It was so contrarian, although you got to wonder, what was George III thinking? Was he going across the channel? They're killing kings? And he's not excited? I don't know. I guess, the channel, they talk about the fog rolls in and the rest of the continent is separated from Britain because they can't see across the channel. Well, maybe that's what George thought. But it was a very contrarian view, and in fact, Burke broke with the leader of his party over his opposition to the French Revolution. Ultimately, the party came back to him, and the king actually said, Burke, I've read your book. I think you're right. So maybe we should add to history, tradition, and experience a willingness to be persistent, not necessarily resistant, but persistent. His reaction to the French Revolution galvanized an already conservative inclination which had been developed because of the history that was so proximate to his life and which was so clear to him, followed on by, during his life, American Revolution, supported the colonists, didn't support freedom for America. He supported the rights of Englishmen who live in the colonies. It's different. It's also consistent with his philosophy. Stability. All of the revolutions that we have talked about that resulted in terrible bloodshed, upheaval, overthrow of existing ways of life were a result of not slow development, not gradual development, but radical change. So, one of the things Burke liked, and this is perhaps surprising given the time in which he lived, in which the nobility and landed gentry was very much a part of the life that he lived. As a matter of fact, he said when he bought his estate and paid too much for it and had to go into debt that it's impossible to break into the landed gentry unless you pay more for your property than you can afford, because they want to watch and see how you do with that. He actually didn't do all that well with that. He died pretty much a pauper, but he didn't give up the property before he died either. Let's talk about something else that Burke was a believer in. This is before Jack Kemp, Bill Roth, Ronald Reagan. He was a supply sider. Who, he said, is to judge what profit is appropriate? Surely no one on earth. The question is, what's it worth to the buyer? I spent some time, several occasions in the former Soviet Union as they were overthrowing communism, pre-Yeltsin, in fact. And I remember being, let's talk about how markets work. I remember being asked by one of the Russians, I want to ask something I don't understand about the United States. Talk to me about potato chips. Okay, we'll talk about potato chips. He said, how do you know where to send the potato chips? How do you know that? How do you know that Joe's grocery store gets 8 cases and Mallory's grocery store gets 16? How do you know that? Who tells you that? Who's in charge of that? Well, obviously the markets are in charge of that. Burke got that. While he was in Parliament, some bright spark decided that they were going to put a tax on corn because there was too much of it, or they want to make some money off it or something. Absolutely opposed to that. Absolutely opposed to that. Shortage of grain. Grain price goes up. Solution in Parliament. Let's build a bunch of granaries around the kingdom. And then we can take the corn and we can put it in the granaries, and then we can let it out as people need it. Burke says, are you crazy? When the government buys the corn, the government goes into business against itself. So it pays too much for the corn. Now it's got to give the corn away, and the people have got to pay for the too much that they paid for the corn, which doesn't do them any good because they get it cheaper later. It's a market lesson. By the way, the corn tax did not work, and they didn't build the granaries. Compulsory equalization. Compulsory equalization. Does this have any faint ringings today? Burke said, equalizers never raise what is low, they pull down what is high. Never raise what is low, they pull down what is high. That's a debate that's going on right now. That's a debate that's going to get sharper and more important over the next few months, I believe. All markets are related. How about ethanol and corn? Ethanol subsidy. Farmers grow a lot of corn. It's used to make ethanol. Oh, price of food goes up. Price of feed goes up for the corn-eating critters we eat. So food's gone up. Only thing that, well, it went up anyway, gasoline. But you really can't mess around in a market, says Burke, unless you're willing to accept the consequences. And the consequences seldom, if ever, provide what it is that you thought you wanted when you started to mess with it. And lest you wonder about labor is a commodity. If there isn't enough labor and I need it, I'm willing to pay more. If there's too much labor, I'm going to be able to pay less. And you've heard this argument today on the minimum wage. I'm not suggesting that there may not be reasons that you want to accept the consequences. But if you impose a minimum wage, and I'm an employer, I can avoid the consequences of that by not hiring as many people. So Burke was right about that. It is a commodity. Think about labor unions, though. I've never been a very big supporter of labor unions, but it seems to me that the willingness to withhold labor if it's a commodity is a legitimate way to address the employer. Except if the result of your withholding work gets you a wage that is too high for the product to be saleable, then everybody's going to suffer from that. So again, that's if you're going to intervene, try to understand the consequences of your intervention and whether they are good and whether your intervention is more than you need to do or just about right. He also said two other things that are here in my notes. I'm not sure they fit right at this juncture, but they're too important to leave out. Once you look to the government for bread, you will always expect it. That's sort of worth thinking about today. And this is worth thinking about even more. Do not inflame the poor versus the rich. We are in it together. That's all got to do with markets. It's all got to do with our history, our tradition, our experience. If we ignore or abandon those principles of Burke, we do it at our risk, and we need to carefully consider whether we're willing to accept the consequences of it. Burke and the church. I mentioned before that in public education and civil policy, Burke thought that the church should not meddle. But he was clearly a very religious man in the sense of a belief in God and the importance of the history and tradition and experience of the church and what it had meant in England. Another question for today. We have a growing secularism in the United States. Can you teach without reference to faith? Can you maintain society as we know it without religion? That's part of history, tradition, and experience. Huge part of our history, tradition, and experience. It's why people keep talking about the Judeo-Christian ethic of the United States. There is no question about that in terms of our history, our tradition, and our experience. If you take it away, with what do you replace it? I have no idea. I do not go to church every Sunday. I am not here preaching. But I began to worry about the rise of secularism in the United States really before I did all this Burke reading. I began to worry about it in terms of what part of our society does it play? How important? And I think the question comes down to the question I just asked. If you take religion out of the equation, what is the replacement? The only thing I can think of is Rousseau and that man is basically good and inclined to do the right thing with or without control. Burke is rolling in his grave that somebody giving a lecture about him just said that. But that's the question. That's the question. Not are they right from a religious point of view? Say, all right, okay, you're an atheist. Okay, I'm not going to make you go to church every Sunday. I may want to talk to you about why you feel that way, but I'm not challenging your belief. I'm challenging you to tell me how you replace that in this society. Political parties. Burke was a Whig. Burke was not a Whig. Burke was a kind of a contrarian Whig. So even for Burke, opposition was fine, even if it was within your own party. Being able to think your own thoughts, present your own ideas, was a good idea. And he saw political parties as a way to limit the monarch. He was a monarchist. He was a constitutional monarchist. The Whigs were basically constitutional monarchists. So were some of the Tories, but the Whigs certainly. And he got into a significant dust-up with the king over what he saw as the Georges. You know, the three Georges pushed back on this growth of the importance of Parliament and the power of Parliament. They were looking for a way to get things, you know, back a little bit, maybe a little bit more like Charles I. I mean, a little more control over what's going on. And they were doing that by making king's ministers of members of the Tory party in Parliament. And Burke saw that as a very bad idea indeed, and fought against it, and successfully. Easy to see why he did. Having the king come back to being a tyrant, if I can use that inflammatory word, clearly was not part of what Burke saw as a progressive or a progress of history, tradition, and experience. Let's just take what time is left to say a little bit about pain. Pain is, let me back up and say, well, who made what contribution to who we are as a people today, what our government is like, to the American Revolution and the thoughts that created and sustained that revolution. Paine's contribution and Burke's contribution, entirely different. I started when I was thinking about this to say Burke's contribution was far bigger than Paine's. And I guess from my perspective as a politician, that's true. But it's not really a fair comparison. Paine's rhetoric was really actually kind of over the top. But Paine's rhetoric encouraged the colonists to take the steps that they needed to take. And I think you can legitimately wonder whether Burke's philosophy reasoned wordy, and he was very prolix, whether that would have gotten the colonists where they needed to be in terms of freedom from Britain. And actually, Burke was never for American freedom from Britain. Burke provided the serious philosophical underpinning of early American political society, and for the conservative movement that is as appropriate and important today as it was in 1775 and 6. So I think Burke made a bigger contribution to the result, and I think Paine made the contribution to lighting the fire. So I'm willing to give Paine his due. And by the way, Jefferson, big Paine guy. Don't know that he read Burke. Haven't read that he read Burke. He did all right without it. So I think I have about filled my allotted time. We're going to take a break, right? And we'll come back and talk about revolutions and Paine and Burke. And thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it.
Welcome back. We're here with David A. Norcross. David is the quintessential guy that puts together all the various factions of the conservative movement. But he's also studied for a long time what is the conservative movement. And your lecture has just been outstanding. We can't thank you enough for the insights you've provided.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you again. Let's have a discussion now. As we left, I was saying that when we came back, we were going to talk briefly about Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. What's the difference? Are they the same? Are they different? Is it the same philosophy? Please, that's later.
I think one of the fundamental differences between Paine and Burke is that if you get back to the Aristotle position that men are political animals, that they would differ on that. And that's why Paine believes that governments have to have the reaffirmed consent of each generation, of each citizen, because that government is not natural, whereas Burke is more okay with something like a monarchy because he believes that you have to have a government for the citizens.
Want to comment on that?
Not bad. Probably gives... maybe gives Paine a little more credit for organization than I would, but good.
A lot of people talk about Paine and... I'm sorry, about Burke, Edmund Burke, and they try to figure out where he got a lot of his ideas and views from. And we had some readings of Blackstone, and some people would say that some of the Burkean thought is an evolution of some of the Blackstone thought. Now, Blackstone is the first, for all intents and purposes, the first major legal theorist that we really study. Would you agree with that?
I would. And in fact, I have a small book of my grandfather's. My grandfather was a lawyer. And when he was admitted to the bar, the guy he read law with gave him a book on Blackstone, the commentaries.
Blackstone basically codifies the common law tradition. And by this common law tradition, he begins to develop the concept that rights are inherent in man and they're given by God, which Burke then picks up. And the whole concept of tradition is really part of the common law tradition. I mean, it's the same words.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there was a part in the lecture that we didn't get to because I was long-winded about the common law. And the common law, which is peculiar to America and Britain for the most part, is very consistent with Burke's philosophy. Blackstone kind of set it all down, and as you said, he laid it out for Burke. Burke took it from there. But the common law, which develops, instead of having a statute that tells you what you may do and may not do, the common law codifies, wrong word, puts in writing by way of decisions what the current advance of society in particular relations is.
And remember, this is at odds with the Napoleonic philosophy where the state is the author of the rights. The state is not the author of the rights. Man has certain inherent rights given to him by God, and those rights become part of the tradition. So that's a major difference. Legal and political rights become organized in a tradition, and it's that natural law, natural rights, legal tradition that kind of reorganizes them. Well, let's take some questions from you all here. Questions, please. Please, go ahead.
You talked about how we have a government that's set up to have gradual change over time, or set to be slowly progressive. Do you think this slow progression that we've had over the past 250 years has taken us too far away from our roots, and now we're kind of snowballing into a time of progression for the sake of progression?
I think any form of government that is in fact democratic has within it the seeds of the possibility that you're going to go too far. And I think that's where we are. I don't think it's if we're true to Burke, we're not going to go too far. We're going to realize that we can't outstrip tradition, history, and experience. But clearly, in any government where the majority rules, you can go too far. And that's the next step beyond when you look to the government for bread. If you get it, you will always look to it for bread. That's how we got there.
But keep in mind what Mr. Norcross said earlier was that America, at least in the early days, look back to Paine. And Paine does not find tradition important. As a matter of fact, he wants to start things de novo. And so there is this tension between Burke thought and the thought of Paine. Question, Mr. Faust. Cadet Faust.
My question is about today we try to export democracy to other countries quite often. One of the things that you said about conservatism is that it's based off of our traditions and our history and what we developed. Do you believe that that's one of the problems that we have exporting democracy to other countries is because it's not rooted in their traditions and their history?
Absolutely. I was called upon Tunisia, Nigeria, and Russia to try to to give advice and how to develop political parties. And in Nigeria, both Nigeria and Tunisia, the question was they wanted political parties, but they didn't want any opposition. And political parties are perforce made up of the government and opposition. So when you have a tradition that doesn't accept opposition, then it's difficult for us to export our democracy to them, which doesn't mean we shouldn't try. But my view is that they're going to have to go through a long period of trial and error, hopefully not as long as Britain did, before they get there. But yeah, you can't pick it up and put it there. Burke nailed it. The tradition isn't there. The history isn't there. And the experience isn't there.
Next question.
Good question.
Mr. Stewart.
In what you had mentioned earlier, you had brought up the Arab Spring, and in relation to Burke or in unrelation to Burke, would you say Tunisia is a closer relation to Burke's ideals than what has happened in many of the other countries that was part of that movement they deposed one particular leader, but they more or less kept a form of government that was similar, only they created electoral process.
Who's they? I missed the who is they?
The transitional government there.
Ooh, I don't know. I don't really know what they are. I mean, they may be, you're right. They may be trying to provide that bridge to tradition. Arab Spring, I think I said this in the lecture, all the countries engaged in the Arab Spring have an enormous problem with religion because they need religion to be in the box. It can't be the government, the revolution, and that's hard. I mean, our tradition found that difficult. You know, Henry VIII, it was out of the box.
Mr. Norcross went on in his lecture to say about throwing out, Payne wants to throw the baby out with the bathwater. He does that, but he does that because he believes in trying to establish a utopian society.
I meant to answer Payne. Payne might love the Arab Spring.
Yeah, but Burke goes on to say that when you do throw out tradition, tyranny comes.
And Payne would say, "Didn't come to us."
That's exactly right. But Payne would also go a step further and say, "If you do believe on the inherent rights granted by God to man and discoverable through nature, that won't happen." But that's the issue.
It's a leap.
Cadet Salmaska, you had a question.
I found it interesting that when you mentioned that Burke advocated progress, because today when we hear the term progress or progressives in politics, you know, we don't think of people like Edmund Burke. It's a whole different ideology.
You may have noticed that I slipped and said progressive once when I meant progress.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just throwing that out there. But would you say that, you know, progressives today who advocate, you know, the course of action that they do you think it's divorced from history and experience and tradition?
Yeah, I think, well, the progressives have named themselves progressives because the word is less inflammatory than liberal has become, but there's really not much difference. If the progressives were willing to move forward slowly, to progress with some attention to history, tradition, and experience, then I would have no quarrel with them. And neither would Burke, because Burke was certainly not anti-progress. Where the question becomes critical is at what point, well, let's just pick Obamacare. Is that progressive? Is that within the bounds of our history, tradition, and experience, or is that too much? And obviously we have two very vigorous sides to that question. But you've put your finger right on it. When is too much progress bad? When it's too fast is the glib answer to that. But it is glib.
I'm going to switch a little bit to another topic. Property rights. How do property rights fit into all this? My property, your property. How does it fit into all this? Where does Burke, Payne come down on that particular issue? Anybody have any ideas? You mentioned Mr. Stewart. Then I'll go to Mr. Slater.
Property rights are key in the protection of liberty because property gives you power in relation to the government. Without property, you do not have necessarily liberties guaranteed to you without the right to possess it.
Just from our reading, you know, Burke was one of the few things that Burke wanted government to have a role in economics was for the protection of property. You know, he thought it was, I guess, you know, the key to maintaining that.
I would go, yes.
Burke mentioned the idea of having hereditary property as turning selfishness and greed into a virtue, which I thought was kind of an interesting way to think about it, that through one being able to secure property and pass it on to those who they wish to pass it on to, that was a way of taking something that was greedy and selfish, but essentially turning it into a good for society, which is kind of, it seems kind of a basis for kind of the difference between that I see between Payne and Burke comes down to what they think about the nature of a human being. Whereas Burke would consider, you know, man fallible, Payne would consider man able to, you know, be the best possible option for himself.
Do you think Payne cared
about
whether man was fallible or infallible? Did he look beyond creating the opportunity for something new? I don't know the answer to this.
I don't know. I think. He definitely seemed to care. It's interesting, they both care about the same set of rights. Like, Payne mentions property rights in The Rights of Man. But it's interesting because he views the natural rights as man's inherent rights and the institutions as a threat to those rights. Whereas for Burke, man is the threat to those rights and the institutions are what protect them.
If I can jump in for 1 second, I would suggest, however, that starting with Blackstone, that and Burke and Payne, they both affirm the natural limitations of the state. And if you go all the way back, as Mr. Slater mentioned Aristotle before, they are affirming the natural limitations of the state. There is a fundamental, and this is the property rights issue I'm going back to. So I think they're reaffirming limitations of the states by saying property rights. You wanted to?
No, I don't have a quarrel with that.
Yes, Mr. Faust.
Well, I think to look at it the way that Payne did look at just an answer, or trying to answer your question, the way that he approached it, you have to consider man good because for man to be able to set up good government, because the way he looked at it was government was created through man coming together in a compact through nature. So, in essence, I would think he would say it was good, where Burke would say that man is naturally biased, if not naturally evil. And that also goes all the way back to what you were talking about as far as religion goes. I mean, if you take religion into account, because Payne was all about kind of throwing the religion out with everything else, as we saw in the French Revolution, and again, the social contract, where Burke believed in religion, believed in the fall of man, and that's one of the reasons why he thought that government was so essential in keeping government going, was to keep in check man, and that the liberties that came out that were protected were through the tradition and came out over time because they were given to us by God.
I agree with that.
Okay.
Good answer.
Questions? Yes, sir, Mr. Thomas. Good, Thomas.
Yes, sir. I noticed you said the American Civil War was a failed revolution of sorts. I was just asking, could you elaborate on that a little more?
In honor of my wife, the War of Northern Aggression.
Or the war between states. Did I slip and call it the Civil War?
Yes.
Well, if you look at, I was looking at the Civil War as a serious upheaval. And then looking at what happened as a result of it. No question about the bad feelings, no question about how long they lasted, but it was a serious upheaval. It was, in many ways, a revolution by the Confederate States against the United States. And yet, as disastrous as that war was, both the commerce and people, particularly in the Confederacy, we came through that reasonably well. I admit that there was years of bad feelings, but we were one government. We fought the First World War together. We fought the Second World War together. That seems to me says something about Burkean principles. They were the same institutions. The institution of slavery, set that aside for a moment. The Confederate States set up a government just like the United States. So the history, tradition, experience, save for the issue of slavery, all pretty much the same, which is how we came through it without it turning into a French Revolution. And I don't think had the result been different, and I guess you should talk to Newt about his book, I haven't read it. I don't think if the results were different that the two countries would have been antagonists for very long. spoken as a Yankee who lives in Virginia. And has for a while.
Who now lives in Virginia.
I said, who lives in.
I thought you were from New Jersey.
I'm from Virginia, sir. That's why I said Confederacy, carefully.
Thanks. Next question. Yes, sir.
While we're on the topic of the Civil War, the war between the states or Northern aggression, sir, would you consider the Reconstruction period that we went into after that agreeing with Burke's philosophy? Some of the lasting effects from that period still impact our the efficiency of our government to this day.
Yeah, they do. Badly. Negatively. If you read Crane Britton's book on the anatomy of revolution, the Reconstruction, it seems to me, was clearly what he calls thermidor, which is when things begin to return to some degree of normalcy. I don't think Burke would have looked very kindly on the Reconstruction. I don't think Lincoln would have looked very kindly on the Reconstruction. I would use that as further proof that our principles, our Burkean principles, helped us survive not only the war but the Reconstruction. No, I'd give the Reconstruction French Revolution bad grades. It wasn't nearly that bad, and there's another measure. It was not nearly as bad as the period after the French Revolution, but certainly not positive, and I don't think anything we ought to be proud of.
Next question. Yes, sir. That's all that.
Payne, in Common Sense, he writes, "Government, like dress, is the badge of lost innocence. The palaces of kings are built on the ruins of the bowers of paradise." And you could kind of tie that with how Burke says any government is better than no government. Whereas with Payne, he says government like dress, it's necessary. And do you think that necessary view of government, I guess it's a stark contrast from the libertarian branch of thought, but is that a reflection of their attitude of man?
And by the way, we will have a class devoted to libertarian thought. We'll have the head of the Ayn Rand Institute, Dr. Yaron Brook, and I hope you'll ask him that same question at that time too. Please, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I guess, do you think their view of government is really an outgrowth of their view of man, where I guess the impulses of conscious, for Payne writes, if the impulses of conscience were clear, uniform, irresistibly obeyed, man would need no other lawgiver. So that's kind of saying man isn't infallible. And
you want me to parse necessary. What did he mean by necessary? Is his what the quote that you just offered of Payne, I think, distinguishes him from Burke. Burke starts with the notion that government is what keeps in line man so that man has the opportunity for improvement. Payne, I think, he takes a more grudging view of government's organizing and controlling than Burke does, which figures because Burke wanted to progress. Burke didn't want us to be free of England. Payne wanted to throw the bomb. Change. And if you do that, you've got to have some realization that something else has to follow. So I think he had he certainly was not opposed to any kind of government. Certainly wasn't much in favor of a centralized executive, but he would have centralized power in one great legislature, which looks a lot like France. As you can tell, I'm mistrustful of Payne.
Based upon the Arab Spring, David, how would you like to have seen that go? What should America's role be in it? It's a big question.
If we were in a debate and I was looking for an answer that would please the crowd, I would say, I have absolutely no idea. I really don't. You know, there were people criticizing Obama for what he did in Tunisia, what he didn't do in Egypt, what he's not doing in Syria. I honestly don't know what, I don't know what the answer is. I came at it from a very negative perspective, having spent, as you know, a fair amount of time in the Middle East, and being mindful of the fact that they do not have our traditions for us to export. I'm not. I think I come down on the side of you watch and see what they make of it.
Well, if we go to Iraq, I mean, let's take a look at Iraq. We wiped out the entire Ba'ath Party. The party that actually was ruling the country.
Might not have been a good idea.
And I think we're now finding out that some of the people who made those decisions are actually questioning their own decisions in having done that. Because by doing that, they wiped out an infrastructure and a tradition within that country. Burke.
Exactly.
And Payne, to some extent, too. Question is, what are we doing now? Have we learned anything from that? Can we apply those Burkean principles, that the Blackstone principles of a common law tradition in the legal system, can we apply them to what's going on in the Arab Spring today?
I don't think so, and that's okay. what's so so frustrating. They lack any of the structure and tradition and history and experience that we have in a form of government. They simply haven't experienced that.
Well, let's take a look at Afghanistan, a really tough place to be in, and I've had friends there, I've been there. I mean, when you look at Afghanistan, you're looking at the Taliban, which have a very strong tradition, a very strong base, and we have been trying to establish a government over them with no strong tradition, with no strong base, with no legal system that's grown up over decades. And that, I pose to you, as is one of the serious problems with trying to bring peace to that particular country. I think some of those same lessons apply to what's going on today in other places in the Arab world. David?
Absolutely. No doubt. And they, in turn, and I think I touched on this, forget us for the moment. Mm-hmm. They, in turn, in trying to build a government of free men and women, don't have the tradition or experience to do it. They can look to us, but they can only make that a part of what they're trying to do. They really got to do it on their own. The only thing we can provide, and you have to do this very carefully, is the opportunity for them to have the time to do that without picking sides.
It's hard not to pick sides.
It may not be possible.
As you so well put it, and I know you've been a strong critic of President Obama, but in that particular case, he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't.
I agree.
So even though we're a critic in that particular case, it's a tough one. We got time for a couple more questions. How about another two more questions? Yes, sir. Cadet Ford.
Sir, in talking about the Arab Spring, Afghanistan, Iraq, is it possible to take the conservative canon, the conservative philosophy, and insert it into their government? Burke says bad government's better than no government.
That's right.
There is a long-standing tradition in the Middle East, but it's misdirected compared to our democracy. Sharia law is a twist off of the Ten Commandments. Is it possible to take that tradition, that experience, and build? Saudi Arabia's done a good job at it, and they have what most could consider good government by the definition of good government. Is it possible to use that as the starting point and that experience to help these governments out?
Well, I'm tempted to say if you can get from Henry VIII to Barack Obama, you can do it. But I trip. My Western sensibilities and senses of man and woman as I see them trip over Sharia law. I can't. Yes, I suppose the absolutely objective answer is yes, you can get from there to here, and that at some point, you know, we didn't give women the vote until about 125 years ago. So, yeah, I guess they can get from here to there. My question is whether their religion wants them to get from here to there. And I admit that in the Burkean sense, religion is a huge part of their tradition. And, in fact, a part of their tradition with which they struggle. Look at Turkey. Turkey made enormous progress by secularizing its society. And yet I stood here, what, an hour ago and derailed the secularization of American society. You can't tell everybody always the right thing to do.
Sir.
Yes, sir.
Speaking within, you know, the confines of America, I found it interesting you were talking about the move, the secular shift of America, and when religion gets taken out, what do we replace it with? That there's some necessary component in society that religion provides, and once you get rid of religion, it's got to be replaced with something. How would you answer someone who suggested, you know, we replace it with some sort of secular humanism where we as individuals hold the answers and can look nowhere to ourselves for, you know,
that's the right response. Mm-hmm. And that is a response that Rousseau and the Romantics would love. I don't think it works. I mean, I don't think there's sufficient discipline in that substitute for it to truly substitute for religion in our society. But that's a logical question to ask. And I thought about that for a long time before I even posed to myself the question, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this is it's a big part of our tradition lifted and thrown overboard. Okay, understand that. What's the substitute? I can't find a substitute in my own mind that is really a substitute.
Because I think all too often today we hear about religion and it's characterized how it's superstition, it's bigoted, but we're not having a discussion on beneficial elements that it contains.
We're not having a discussion about what it means for our society. We're having a discussion which is sort of between denominations and yes, you're exactly right. And I think the latter is the discussion that we need to have, particularly with the secularists, is, okay, you don't believe. I get it. I understand it. I'm not going to try to convince you otherwise. But you can't take religion out of the equation and have the same thing that you have now. Is that what you really want? They're going to say to me, you're wrong. That's not what religion is. Which is why I said to you that they can be agnostic if they want, but they cannot say that religion was not a huge and important building block foundation to our society. You just can't say that.
Final words?
I had most of the words of the day. You may sum up, sir.
Well, it'd be impossible to sum up. There was so much material. Just a couple of quick little takeaways. Property rights are inflexible. And I think you'd find that from all of our readings. You could glean that
definitely
from.
Definitely Burke.
Definitely Burke. And Payne as well.
Yes, but Burke just really.
And going back to Blackstone. Inflexible. And our entire American legal tradition is an outgrowth of the English and based on Blackstone as well, and going back even before Blackstone. Blackstone's first to actually write it down and codify it and actually make some sense out of
Blackstone,
it. But it goes back before him.
He went back to William I.
And lastly, legal and political rights have to be recognized in tradition, and that they're an outgrowth of the inherent rights given by God and discoverable through nature. I thank you so much for being here today. I thank our guests for coming.
Lectures in History airs each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. We feature classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. To keep up with American History TV during the week, or to send us your questions and comments, follow us on Twitter. We're at twitter.com/cspanhistory.